There are, beloved listeners, such a lot of contradictions when it comes to how the world does food, and I'm not talking about gourmet cooking. While around 800 million are still going hungry every day, the numbers of overweight kids and adults continues to rise. And while we produce more food than ever, it's a paradox that farmers and their kids are often the hungry ones. How do we get into the mess and how do we get out of it? Discussed at the UN Nations Food Systems Summit, held last week, farmers, scientists, academics, environmental activists, NGOs, big food corps and many others converged to look at this complex issue of how we produce, eat and contemplate food in a world with changing climate. Now, to hear more about the summit and those global fuel issues, we are joined by Bill Pritchard. Bill is Professor in Geography and Head of School of Geosciences up the road at the University of Sydney. He's written numerous books and papers focused on food, agriculture, rural development, and has a particular interest in rural India, Myanmar, and Asia. His most recent book is The Routledge Handbook of Food and Nutrition Security. William, welcome.
Lovely to speak to you, Philip. Call me Bill.
Not I
Bill.
Shall I indeed. I promise I shall do so. Now, the UN's been holding these food summits on and off since 1974. Are they evolving?
Oh, they certainly are. The thing about the summits is, you know, they're like a picture frame. They bring everyone together. But what really happens that's important is in the lead up and the discussions that they inspire. They're a magnet for bringing all those thoughts and ideas bubbling to the surface. And that's kind of what we've seen this time around. I mean, every time the UN convenes one of these summits, there's a slightly different theme, and you can sort of really see the ideas evolving over time. And, you know, very much this current summit was all about how we might think of the food crisis and the climate crisis and, I guess, planetary boundaries more generally, how we might integrate those concerns and think a way forward.
Now, Bill, the big first at this summit was the decision to look at food security issues as a system.
That's right. So if we go back in time, food was more or less considered in these summits as an entity in itself. So people were concerned with, well, is there enough food being produced and what do we have to do to boost production? Or how is it distributed and what are the rights and entitlement of people to gain access to food? What we're doing now in this current summit is to consider, it's not just enough to say we need to produce more food. As you said in your intro, we produce enough food anyway. It's food not of the right dietary and calorific mixes, but it's also food produced in ways that are clearly unsustainable for the 21st century economy. So thinking of it as a system, bringing in the environment and bringing in decent work and livelihoods and gender issues. Women are key components in the food system. They do most of the cooking and most of the work on farms and factories. So gender rights are very much part of this. Thinking of this whole issue in systemic terms, addressing those kind of livelihood, human rights, gender rights, and environmental and climate concerns was very much part of what people were considering just last week.
And, of course, it would have been a seething hotbed of politics, both up front and behind the scenes, because, you know, like all UN summits, official representation from countries who are all determined to pursue their own interests.
Oh, absolutely. But in this case, I mean, the politics was, you know, there was almost like a sort of a fire in the front room with the politics going on. There was around, I think, 600 NGOs who boycotted the summit, and they did so largely because the summit said very transparently, I think, that that corporations should be part of the mix, that they should be in the room discussing issues. And a lot of NGOs, civil society groups, thought that that was tantamount to corporate capture, and so they decided to boycott the summit. But I'd probably have to also say equally, there were many, many, many others that participated in the summit. And I guess what you say is true. You know, it goes back to politics. You can I guess in any debate, there's a decision by participants to either, take a posture to say we're going to participate or not, or to engage and be pragmatic. And I think we saw that being played out last week.
Now, Bill, the US agricultural policy has for decades been captured by big agri-corp interests, and so corporate interests have played a growing part at the summits?
Well, it's quite a few years since the last summit, so this was certainly the first time that corporate interests were so central to it. Look, I think it's fair to say that that many markets, whether we talk about agricultural commodity markets, agricultural input markets, and certainly the financialisation of food, are more open to big corporate interests than ever before. So I think there's very real concerns about the role of corporations in the global food system. I think that's undeniable amongst most commentators. At the same time, and this is the Gordian knot we have, if we are going to make any progress in resolving these issues, we can't keep corporations locked out, because at the same time, they are major players. So there needs to be some sort of engagement, but without capture, if that's possible. And I know there's some contradictions in that statement.
It will also surprise the listener to learn that 26% of global greenhouse gas emissions are contributed by the agricultural sector.
So you know, I mean, food's both the cause and effect of climate change. It's an enormous emitter in its own right, and a lot of that is because much of the food we produce is produced in 20th century ways with big fossil fuel inputs to sustain the whole system. A lot of food miles. We're still transporting a lot of food by air freight, even in the pandemic. So it's a great contributor to greenhouse gas emissions. But this is the flip side. Once we see climate change get upwards to 1.5 to 2%, we're going to see dramatic negative impacts in terms of our ability to feed people, regardless of how we might do it. All the modelling's telling us that. So the relationship between climate change and food systems is completely tied up, both in the sense of food being a contributor to climate change and also a victim from it.
In trouble with his own climate change deniers, our Prime Minister is always talking about techno fixes, but they're a part of this, aren't they? Because we should be trying to get new varieties of food that are more climate resistant and much more localisation and more plant protein.
And this is why I think a view of just keeping corporations out is a little bit narrow-minded, notwithstanding my early comments about corporate capture. Look, we need multiple pathways here. You know, what we need to do on the one hand is to say we need new technologies, climate-resilient seeds, new forms of agriculture, and there are techno fixes required there. But we also need to transition to sort of a rewiring of the system at the same time, away from large-scale agriculture reliant on fossil fuel into new forms of agriculture, potentially more agroecological, that are using the natural cycles between biological systems to replace our dependence on fossil fuel inputs.
Let's look at the big picture. How bad, Bill, is the hunger problem?
Oh, it's terrible. Look, you quoted earlier about 800 million people. I mean, this is the thing. That equates to, roughly about 10% of the world's population. Now, a few years ago, the number of hungry people was about 8.5% of the world's population. That's as recent as 2018. Now, obviously, COVID has had a very negative effect on world hunger, but even before then, the trends were going backwards. And it's not just hungry people. You know, we've also got hidden hunger, which is people who have enough calories but don't have a healthy diet. And we've also got this problem of overweight and obesity. In fact, today I read a just-published research paper on India, on dietary trends amongst women in India, that found that the fastest-growing rates of obesity and overweight were Indian women living in slums. Now, not the middle class, but the sort of the people in poverty-stricken situations. So that's telling you that when people in those situations are getting enough food, the kind of foods that they're only able to access because they're poor are calorie-dense bad food. So that's contributing to a dietary problem in the other end.
So nutrition on the one hand, malnutrition on the other. And you report from the conference that hunger's on the rise in parts of Asia and also in Africa.
Yeah, look, the two hotspots, if you like, for world hunger are sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, mainly India, but the other countries around it. There has been greater progress in East Asia and Southeast Asia, which were problematic a few years ago, and Latin America is a somewhat complex story to tell, but it's certainly the big hotspots globally are South Asia and sub-Saharan Africa.
Bill, people focus on hunger when there's famine or near famine, which in its own obscene way is quite photogenic, but the problem is more subtle, isn't it?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, the mainstream story of hunger in the world is not starvation, although that still exists. The mainstream story is chronic hunger, which is people defined really as people not getting enough calories on a day-to-day basis to maintain normal bodily function. So they're skipping meals, they're eating smaller meals, they're going without for the sake of their children or something like that. And, you know, we're seeing that's a huge problem. The thing is, you know, chronic hunger is bad. You know, we all know what the feeling of hunger feels like. It's uncomfortable. But writ large, over time, chronic hunger is what we can call a sort of an intensifier of what the Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen called unfreedoms. So the idea is, you know, if you're young, particularly if you're a child who is chronically hungry, That impairs your cognitive development. It means you're probably missing school. It means you won't be healthier in later life. So, you know, your family might get into better circumstances later, and by your teens you might have, you know, three meals a day, but the long-term effects on that are going to drag on your health. And there's a lot of studies that show people in those situations have poorer life outcomes.
Staying in India for just a bit longer, you mentioned in your introduction that gender comes into this, and I'm wondering whether religion does as well. Is there a difference between the nutritional standards of Hindus in Modi's India and Muslims?
It's a complex question because it's an intersectional question. Your religion is not the only thing that defines your position in society. So we can try and normalise all those other things out, class and gender and urban or rural status and all that. The data's a bit messy. It doesn't really point to anything. I think the one thing I would say is that vegetarian Hindus in India don't necessarily have worse diets or worse nutritional outcomes than meat-eating Muslims. That's the general message.
Food is a human right. Has it been made such legally anywhere?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. I mean, governments signed up to various UN human rights declarations starting from the late 1940s, I guess, and they were sort of toothless, right? I mean, what did that mean, the right to food, human rights? What does that mean? It only makes a difference when it's put into effect by national constitutions or by courts and parliaments across the land. And various countries around the world, certainly in recent times, have been actively translating this concept of the right to food into a legislative right that their populations have. India is probably the most prominent example of that, but there's other instances in South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa. It was one of the things that the Mandela government did after attaining power, and also in parts of South America and Bolivia and Brazil, we've seen that as well.
Was genetic modification on the agenda?
It's never not on the agenda. My personal view, I think the debate about GM has been going on for a few decades now. Some of the early prognostications would have had that we were all eating genetically modified food always now, and I think the potential has been much weaker than those initial expectations. I sort of come at this largely from an empirical rather than an ideological basis. I think if there was good evidence that genetic modification worked And I think there's some evidence that it sort of reduces reliance on pesticides and things like that. It has merit, but I think it's not a silver bullet. And for me, the question always is, well, who owns the intellectual property? You know, you get lots of companies saying genetic modification is the future, but, you know, oftentimes they own the patents, they own the intellectual property behind it. And I think there are clear conflicts of interest that need to be brought to the surface.
Bill, as a very small scale organic farmer, I view agribusiness with deep suspicion. And I guess that the big food companies are making pledges about zero hunger and the like.
Well, they certainly are. Of course, what those companies are doing and what they have done, you know, a lot of these companies have signed up to these pledges, is they're like corporate codes of conduct. I mean, a company can't solve hunger. I mean, that's a bit nonsensical, but a company can say, we'll contribute to it by paying our workers right, not having discrimination in the workplace, only using authorised pesticides and things like that. They're probably not going to transition to the kind of organic farm that you might have, Philip. I don't know.
Okay. Now, some, of course, would see this as greenwashing.
Yeah, well, that's 600 NGOs boycotted the UN Food Summit for exactly that reason, yeah.
Did they have their own, if you say, off-Broadway summit at the same time?
Yeah, there was a few things going on. There were those sort of off-Broadway summits. There was also the UN did have an explicit NGO conference, so those NGOs who didn't boycott were given a voice. And if you look at the agenda for that, there were issues like agroecology on the agenda and things that were slightly different to some of the narratives elsewhere. So there was a voice. But of course, at the same time, a number of NGOs would have said the voice wasn't strong enough.
I should have asked you this at the beginning. Instead, I'm going to ask it now at the end. Please define food security. The term is used all the time.
Oh, yeah. So this is the thing. This is the thing that drives me nuts. Many people, when they hear that term, they think of it as, do we have enough grains of rice in the silos? You know, food security being, is it secure for the nation? It's not that at all, right? Food security is defined as everyone in a society having the ability to access the food they need for their health and for their cultural rights. So it's really food security is really a human-centered definition. Of course, to meet those objectives means that you need availability of food, you need food in silos and storehouses and the like, but it's fundamentally defined through the prism of hunger. Is there enough food to make a whole society secure in its day-to-day food needs? It's not just how much food that we have.
A very articulate contribution, and I thank you for it. Professor Bill Pritchard, head of the School of Geosciences at the University of Sydney. Bill's written numerous books and papers focused on food, agriculture and rural development. His most recent is the Routledge Handbook of Food and Nutrition Security, published, not surprisingly, by Routledge.